and failed to go to sleep. The next day he restlessly paced the empty corridors of the ship, pretending not to look for her, though he knew she wasn't there. He ignored the computer's querulous demands to know just what the hell was going on around here by fitting a small electronic gag across a pair of its terminals. After a while, he began to turn down the lights. There was nothing to see. Nothing was about to happen. Lying in bed one night, and night was now virtually continuous on the ship, he decided to pull himself together, to get things into some kind of perspective. He sat up sharply and started to pull clothes on. He decided that there must be someone in the universe feeling more wretched, miserable, and forsaken than himself, and he determined to set to and find him. Halfway to the bridge, it occurred to him that it might be Marvin, and he returned to bed. It was a few hours later than this, as he stomped disconsolately about the darkened corridors, swearing at cheerful doors, that he heard the whop said, and it made him very nervous. He leant tensely against the corridor wall and frowned like a man trying to unbend a corkscrew by telekinesis. He laid his fingertips against the wall and felt an unusual vibration. And now he could quite clearly hear slight noises and could hear where they were coming from. They were coming from the bridge. Moving his hand along the wall, he came across something he was glad to find. He moved on a little further, quietly. "Computer," he hissed. "Hmm?" said the computer terminal nearest him, equally quietly. "Is there someone on this ship?"
"Hmm,"
said the computer.
"Well, who is it?"
said the computer.
"What?"
Zaphod buried one of his faces in two of his hands.
"Oh, Zarquan," he muttered to himself.
Then he stared up the corridor towards the entrance to the bridge in the dim distance, from which more and purposeful noises were coming, and in which the gagged terminals were situated.
"Computer,"
he hissed again.
"Hmm?"
"When I ungag you."
"Hmm?"
"Remind me to punch myself in the mouth."
"Mm-mm."
"Either one. Now just tell me this. One for yes, two for no. Is it dangerous?"
"Mm."
"It is?"
"Mm."
"You didn't just go mm twice."
"Mm-mm."
"Hmm." He inched his way up the corridor as if he would rather be yarding his way down it, which was true. He was within 2 yards of the door to the bridge when he suddenly realized to his horror that it was going to be nice to him, and he stopped dead. He hadn't been able to turn off the door's courtesy voice circuits. This doorway to the bridge was concealed from view within it because of the excitingly chunky way in which the bridge had been designed to curve round, and he had been hoping to enter unobserved. He leant despondently back against the wall again and said some words which his other head was quite shocked to hear. He peered at the dim pink outline of the door and discovered that in the darkness of the corridor he could just about make out the sensor field, which extended out into the corridor and told the door when there was someone there for whom it must open and to whom it must make a cheery and pleasant remark. He pressed himself hard back against the wall and edged himself towards the door, flattening his chest as much as he possibly could to avoid brushing against the very, very dim perimeter of the field. He held his breath and congratulated himself on having lain in bed sulking for the last few days, rather than trying to work out his feelings on chest expanders in the ship's gym. He then realized he was going to have to speak at this point. He took a series of very shallow breaths, and then said as quickly and as quietly as he could,
"Door, if you can hear me, say so very, very quietly."
Very, very quietly, the door murmured,
"I can hear you."
"Good. Now, in a moment, I'm going to ask you to open. When you open, I do not want you to say that you enjoyed it, okay?"
"Okay."
"And I don't want you to say to me that I have made a simple door very happy, or that it is your pleasure to open for me and your satisfaction to close again with the knowledge of a job well done, okay?"
"Okay."
"And I do not want you to ask me to have a nice day. You understand?"
"I understand."
"Okay," said Zaphod, tensing himself. "Open Now. The door slid open quietly. Zaphod slipped quietly through. The door closed quietly behind him.
Is that the way you like it, Mr. Beeblebrox?
Said the door out loud.
I want you to imagine, said Zaphod to the group of white robots who swung round to stare at him at that point, that I have an extremely powerful Kilozap blaster pistol in my hand.
There was an immensely cold and savage silence. The robots regarded him with hideously dead eyes. They stood very still. There was something intensely macabre about their appearance, especially to Zaphod, who had never seen one before or ever known anything about them. The Cricket Wars belonged to the ancient past of the galaxy, and Zaphod had spent most of his early history lessons plotting how he was going to have sex with the girl in the cyber cubicle next to him. And since his teaching computer had been an integral part of this plot, it had eventually had all its history circuits wiped and replaced with an entirely different set of ideas, which had then resulted in it being scrapped and sent to a home for degenerate cybermats, whither it was followed by the girl who had inadvertently fallen deeply in love with the unfortunate machine, with the result A, that Zaphod never got near her, and B, that he missed out on a period of ancient history that would have been of inestimable value to him at this moment. He stared at them in shock. It was impossible to explain why, but their smooth and sleek white bodies seemed to be the utter embodiment of clean, clinical evil. From their hideously dead eyes to their powerful, lifeless feet, they were clearly the calculated product of a mind that wanted simply to kill. Zaphod gulped in cold fear. They had been dismantling part of the rear bridge wall and had forced a passage through some of the vital innards of the ship. Through the tangled wreckage, Zaphod could see, with a further and worse sense of shock, that they were tunneling towards the very heart of the ship, the heart of the improbability drive that had been so mysteriously created out of thin air, the heart of gold itself. The robot closest to him was regarding him in such a way as to suggest that it was measuring every smallest particle of his body, mind, and capability. And when it spoke, what it said seemed to bear this impression out. Before going on to what it actually said, it is worth recording at this point that Zaphod was the first living organic being to hear one of these creatures speak for something over 10 billion years. If he had paid more attention to his ancient history lessons and less to his organic being, he might have been more impressed by this honour. The robot's voice was like its body, cold, sleek, and lifeless. It had almost a cultured rasp to it. It sounded as ancient as it was. It said,
"You do have a Kilozap blaster pistol in your hand."
Zaphod didn't know what it meant for a moment, but then he glanced down at his own hand and was relieved to see that what he had found clipped to a wall bracket was indeed what he had thought it was.
"Yeah," he said in a kind of relieved sneer, which is quite tricky. "Well, I wouldn't want to overtax your imagination, robot."
For a while, nobody said anything, and Zaphod realized that the robots were obviously not here to make conversation, and that it was up to him.
"I can't help noticing that you have parked your ship," he said with a nod of one of his heads in the appropriate direction, "through mine."
There was no denying this. Without regard for any kind of proper dimensional behaviour, they had simply materialized their ship precisely where they wanted it to be, which meant that it was simply locked through the heart of gold as if they were nothing more than two combs. Again, they made no response to this, and Zaphod wondered if the conversation would gather any momentum if he phrased his part of it in the form of questions.
"Haven't you?" he added.
"Yes,"
replied the robot.
"Ah, okay," said Zaphod. "So, what are you cats doing here?"
Silence.
"Robots," said Zaphod. "What are you robots doing here?"
"We have come,"
rasped the robot,
"for the gold bale."
Zaphod nodded. He waggled his gun to invite further elaboration. The robot seemed to understand this.
"The gold bale is part of the key we seek,"
continued the robot,
"to release our masters from Cricket."
Zaphod nodded again. He waggled his gun again.
"The key,"
continued the robot simply,
"was disintegrated in time and space. The golden bale is embedded in the device which drives your ship. It will be reconstituted in the key. Our masters shall be released. The universal readjustment will continue.
Zaphod nodded again.
What are you talking about? He said.
A slightly pained expression seemed to cross the robot's totally expressionless face. He seemed to be finding the conversation depressing.
Obliteration,
it said.
We seek the key,
it repeated.
We already have the wooden pillar, the steel pillar, and the perspex pillar. In a moment, we will have the gold bale.
No, you won't.
We will,
stated the robot.
No, you won't. It makes my ship work.
In a moment,
repeated the robot patiently,
we will have the gold bale.
You will not, said Zaphod.
And then we must go,
said the robot, in all seriousness,
to a party.
Oh, said Zaphod, startled. Can I come?
No,
said the robot.
We are going to shoot you.
Oh, yeah?
Said Zaphod, waggling his gun.
Yes,
said the robot, and they shot him. Zaphod was so surprised that they had to shoot him again before he fell down. Chapter 10
Shh, said Slaty Bartfast. Listen and watch.
Night had now fallen on ancient Cricket. The sky was dark and empty. The only light was coming from the nearby town, from which pleasant convivial sounds were drifting quietly on the breeze. They stood beneath a tree from which heady fragrances wafted around them. Arthur squatted and felt the informational illusion of the soil and the grass. He ran it through his fingers. The soil seemed heavy and rich, the grass strong. It was hard to avoid the impression that this was a thoroughly delightful place in all respects. The sky was, however, extremely blank, and seemed to Arthur to cast a certain chill over the otherwise idyllic, if currently invisible, landscape. Still, he supposed, it's a question of what you're used to. He felt a tap on his shoulder and looked up. Slaty Bartfast was quietly directing his attention to something down the other side of the hill. He looked and could just see some faint lights dancing and waving and moving slowly in their direction. As they came nearer, sounds became audible too, and soon the dim lights and noises resolved themselves into a small group of people who were walking home across the hill towards the town. They walked quite near the watchers, beneath the tree, swinging lanterns which made soft and crazy lights dance among the trees and grass, chattering contentedly, and actually singing a song about how terribly nice everything was, how happy they were, how much they enjoyed working on the farm, and how pleasant it was to be going home to see their wives and children, with a lilting chorus to the effect that the flowers were smelling particularly nice at this time of the year, and that it was a pity the dog had died seeing as it liked them so much. Arthur could almost imagine Paul McCartney sitting with his feet up by the fire one evening, humming it to Linda, and wondering what to buy with the proceeds, and thinking probably Essex.
The masters of cricket, breathed Slaty Bartfast in sepulchral tones.
Coming, as it did, so hard upon the heels of his own thoughts about Essex, this remark caused Arthur a moment's confusion. Then the logic of the situation imposed itself on his scattered mind, and he discovered that he still didn't understand what the old man meant.
What?
He said.
The masters of cricket, said Slaty Bartfast again,
and if his breathing had been sepulchral before, this time he sounded like someone in Hades with bronchitis. Arthur peered at the group and tried to make sense of what little information he had at his disposal at this point. The people in the group were clearly alien, if only because they seemed a little tall, thin, angular, and almost as pale as to be white, but otherwise they appeared remarkably pleasant. A little whimsical, perhaps. One wouldn't necessarily want to spend a long coach journey with them, but the point was that if they deviated in any way from being good, straightforward people, it was in being perhaps too nice rather than not nice enough. So why all this rasping lung work from Slaty Bartfast, which would seem more appropriate to a radio commercial for one of those nasty films about chainsaw operators taking their work home with them? Then, this cricket angle was a tough one too. He hadn't quite fathomed the connection between what he knew as cricket and what... Slaty Bartfast interrupted his train of thought at this point as if sensing what was going through his mind. "The game you know as cricket," he said, and his voice still seemed to be wandering lost in subterranean passages, "is just one of those curious freaks of racial memory which can keep images alive in the mind eons after their true significance has been lost in the mists of time. Of all the races in the galaxy, only the English could possibly revive the memory of the most horrific wars ever to sunder the universe and transform it into what I'm afraid is generally regarded as an incomprehensibly dull and pointless game. Rather fond of it myself," he added, "but in most people's eyes you have been inadvertently guilty of the most grotesquely bad taste, particularly the bit about the little red ball hitting the wicket. That's very nasty." Said Arthur, with a reflective frown to indicate that his cognitive synapses were coping with this as best they could.
"And these," said Slarty Bartfast, slipping back into crypt guttural and indicating the group of cricket men who had now walked past them, "are the ones who started it all. And it will start tonight. Come, we will follow and see why."
They slipped out from underneath the tree and followed the cheery party along the dark hill path. Their natural instinct was to tread quietly and stealthily in pursuit of their quarry, though, as they were simply walking through a recorded informational illusion, they could as easily have been wearing euphoniums and woad for all the notice their quarry would have taken of them. Arthur noticed that a couple of members of the party were now singing a different song. It came lilting back to them through the soft night air, and was a sweet romantic ballad which would have netted Macartney Kent and Sussex and enabled him to put in a fair offer for Hampshire.
"You must surely know," said Slarty Bartfast to Ford, "what it is that is about to happen."
"Me?" said Ford. "No."
"Did you not learn ancient galactic history when you were a child?"
"I was in the cyber cubicle behind Zaphod," said Ford. "It was very distracting, which isn't to say that I didn't learn some pretty stunning things."
At this point, Arthur noticed a curious feature to the song that the party were singing. The middle eight bridge, which would have had Macartney firmly consolidated in Winchester and gazing intently over the Test Valley to the rich pickings of the New Forest beyond, had some curious lyrics. The songwriter was referring to meeting with a girl not under the moon or beneath the stars, but above the grass, which struck Arthur as being a little prosaic. Then he looked up again at the bewilderingly blank sky and had the distinct feeling that there was an important point here. If only he could grasp what it was. It gave him a feeling of being alone in the universe, and he said so.
"No," said Slarty Bartfast, with a slight quickening of his step. "The people of cricket have never thought to themselves, 'We are alone in the universe.' They are surrounded by a huge dust cloud, you see, their single sun with its single world, and they are right out on the utmost eastern edge of the galaxy. Because of the dust cloud, there has never been anything to see in the sky. At night it is totally blank, during the day there is the sun, but you can't look directly at that, so they don't. They are hardly aware of the sky. It's as if they had a blind spot which extended 180 degrees from horizon to horizon. You see, the reason why they have never thought we are alone in the universe is that, until tonight, they don't know about the universe. Until tonight." He moved on, leaving the words ringing in the air behind him. "Imagine," he said, "never even thinking we are alone simply because it has never occurred to you to think that there's any other way to be."
He moved on again.
"I'm afraid this is going to be a little unnerving," he added.
As he spoke, they became aware of a very thin, roaring scream high up in the sightless sky above them. They glanced upwards in alarm, but for a moment or two could see nothing. Then Arthur noticed that the people in the party in front of them had heard the noise, but that none of them seemed to know what to do with it. They were glancing around themselves in consternation, left, right, forwards, backwards, even at the ground. It never occurred to them to look upwards. The profoundness of the shock and horror they emanated a few moments later when the burning wreckage of a spaceship came hurtling and screaming out of the sky and crashed about half a mile from where they were standing was something that you had to be there to experience. Some speak of the Heart of Gold in hushed tones. Some of the starship Bistromath. Many speak of the legendary and gigantic starship Titanic, a majestic and luxurious cruise liner launched from the great shipbuilding asteroid complexes of Artefaktavol some hundreds of years ago now, and with good reason. It was sensationally beautiful, staggeringly huge, and more pleasantly equipped than any ship in what now remains of history, but it had the misfortune to be built in the very earliest days of improbability physics, long before this difficult and cussed branch of knowledge was fully, or at all, understood. The designers and engineers decided, in their innocence, to build a prototype improbability field into it, which was meant, supposedly, to ensure that it was infinitely improbable that anything would ever go wrong with any part of the ship. They did not realize that because of the quasi-reciprocal and circular nature of all improbability calculations, anything that was infinitely improbable was actually very likely to happen almost immediately. The starship Titanic was a monstrously pretty sight as it lay beached like a silver Arcturian megavoid whale amongst the laser-lit tracery of its construction gantries, a brilliant cloud of pins and needles of light against the deep interstellar blackness. But when launched, it did not even manage to complete its very first radio message, an SOS, before undergoing a sudden and gratuitous total existence failure. However, the same event which saw the disastrous failure of one science in its infancy also witnessed the apotheosis of another. It was conclusively proved that more people watched Tri-D TV coverage of the launch than actually existed at the time, and this has now been recognised as the greatest achievement ever in the science of audience research. Another spectacular media event of the time was a supernova which the star Isladins underwent a few hours later. Isladins is the star around which most of the galaxy's major insurance underwriters live, or rather lived. But whilst these spaceships and other great ones which come to mind, such as the Galactic Fleet battleships, the GSS Daring, the GSS Audacity, and the GSS Suicidal Insanity, are all spoken of with awe, pride, enthusiasm, affection, admiration, regret, jealousy, resentment, in fact most of the better-known emotions, the one which regularly commands the most actual astonishment was Cricket One, the first spaceship ever built by the people of Cricket. This is not because it was a wonderful ship. It wasn't. It was a crazy piece of near junk. It looked as if it had been knocked up in somebody's backyard, and this was, in fact, precisely where it had been knocked up. The astonishing thing about the ship was not that it was done well, it wasn't, but that it was done at all. The period of time which had elapsed between the moment that the people of Cricket had discovered that there was such a thing as space and the launching of this, their first spaceship, was almost exactly a year. Ford Prefect was extremely grateful as he strapped himself in that this was just another informational illusion and that he was therefore completely safe. In real life, it wasn't a ship he would have set foot in for all the rice wine in China. Extremely rickety was one phrase which sprang to mind, and please may I get out was another. This is going to fly, said Arthur, giving gaunt looks at the lashed together pipework and wiring which festooned the cramped interior of the ship. Slarty Bartfast assured him that it would, that they were perfectly safe, and that it was all going to be extremely instructive and not a little harrowing. Ford and Arthur decided just to relax and be harrowed. Why not, said Ford, go mad. In front of them, and of course totally unaware of their presence for the very good reason that they weren't actually there, were the three pilots. They also had constructed the ship. They had been on the hill path that night singing wholesome, heartwarming songs. Their brains had been very slightly turned by the nearby crash of the alien spaceship. They had spent weeks stripping every tiniest last secret out of the wreckage of the burnt-up spaceship, all the while singing lilting spaceship-stripping ditties. They had then built their own ship, and this was it. This was their ship, and they were currently singing a little song about that too, expressing the twin joys of achievement and ownership. The chorus was a little poignant, and told of their sorrow that their work had kept them such long hours in the garage away from the company of their wives and children, who had missed them terribly, but had kept them cheerful by bringing them continual stories of how nicely the puppy was growing up. Pow! They took off. They roared into the sky like a ship that knew precisely what it was doing.
No way, said Ford a while later, after they had recovered from the shock of acceleration and were climbing up out of the planet's atmosphere. No way, he repeated, does anyone design and build a ship like this in a year, no matter how motivated. I don't believe it. Prove it to me, and I still won't believe it. He shook his head thoughtfully and gazed out of a tiny port at the nothingness outside it. The trip passed uneventfully for a while, and Slarty Bartfast fast wound them through it. Very quickly, therefore, they arrived at the inner perimeter of the hollow, spherical dust cloud which surrounded their sun and home planet, occupying, as it were, the next orbit out. It was more as if there was a gradual change in the texture and consistency of space. The darkness seemed now to thrum and ripple past them. It was a very cold darkness, a very blank and heavy darkness. It was the darkness of the night sky of cricket. The coldness and heaviness and blankness of it took a slow grip on Arthur's heart, and he felt acutely aware of the feelings of the cricket pilots which hung in the air like a thick static charge. They were now on the very boundary of the historical consciousness of their race. This was the very limit beyond which none of them had ever speculated, or even known that there was any speculation to be done. The darkness of the cloud buffeted at the ship. Inside was the silence of history. Their historic mission was to find out if there was anything or anywhere on the other side of the sky from which the wrecked spaceship could have come. Another world, maybe. Strange and incomprehensible though this thought was to the enclosed minds of those who had lived beneath the sky of cricket. History was gathering itself to deliver another blow. Still the darkness thrummed at them, the blank enclosing darkness. It seemed closer and closer, thicker and thicker, heavier and heavier. And suddenly, it was gone. They flew out of the cloud. They saw the staggering jewels of the night in their infinite dust, and their minds sang with fear. For a while they flew on, motionless against the starry sweep of the galaxy, itself motionless against the infinite sweep of the universe. And then they turned round.
It'll have to go,
the men of cricket said as they headed back for home. On the way back, they sang a number of tuneful and reflective songs on the subjects of peace, justice, morality, culture, sport, family life, and the obliteration of all other life forms. Chapter 11. So you see, said Slarty Bartfast, slowly stirring his artificially constructed coffee, and thereby also stirring the whirlpool interfaces between real and unreal numbers, between the interactive perceptions of mind and universe, and thus generating the restructured matrices of implicitly enfolded subjectivity which allowed his ship to reshape the very concept of time and space, how it is. Yes, said Arthur. Yes, said Ford. What do I do, said Arthur, with this piece of chicken? Slarty Bartfast glanced at him gravely. Toy with it, he said. Toy with it. He demonstrated with his own piece. Arthur did so, and felt the slight tingle of a mathematical function thrilling through the chicken leg as it moved four-dimensionally through what Slarty Bartfast had assured him was five-dimensional space. Overnight, said Slarty Bartfast, the whole population of cricket was transformed from being charming, delightful, intelligent, if whimsical, interpolated Arthur, ordinary people, said Slarty Bartfast, into charming, delightful, intelligent, whimsical, manic xenophobes. The idea of a universe didn't fit into their world picture, so to speak. They simply couldn't cope with it, and so charmingly, delightfully, intelligently, whimsically, if you like, they decided to destroy it. What's the matter now? I don't like this wine very much, said Arthur, sniffing it. Well, send it back. It's all part of the mathematics of it. Arthur did so. He didn't like the topography of the waiter's smile, but he'd never liked graphs anyway.
"Where are we going?" said Ford.
"Back to the room of informational illusions," said Slarty Bartfast, rising and patting his mouth with the mathematical representation of a paper napkin. "For the second half." Chapter 12
"The people of cricket,"
said his high judgmental supremacy, Judiciary Pag, LIVR, the learned, impartial and very relaxed, chairman of the board of judges at the cricket war crimes trial,
"are, well, you know, they're just a bunch of real sweet guys, you know, who just happen to want to kill everybody. Hell, I feel the same way some mornings. Okay," he continued, swinging his feet up onto the bench in front of him and pausing a moment to pick a thread off his ceremonial beach loafers, "so you wouldn't necessarily want to share a galaxy with these guys."
This was true. The cricket attack on the galaxy had been stunning. Thousands and thousands of huge cricket warships had leapt suddenly out of hyperspace and simultaneously attacked thousands and thousands of major worlds, first seizing vital material supplies for building the next wave, and then calmly zapping those worlds out of existence. The galaxy, which had been enjoying a period of unusual peace and prosperity at the time, reeled like a man getting mugged in a meadow.
"I mean," continued Judiciary Pag, gazing round the ultramodern —
this was 10 billion years ago, when ultramodern meant lots of stainless steel and brushed concrete — "and huge courtroom,
these guys are just obsessed."
This too was true, and is the only explanation anyone has yet managed to come up with for the unimaginable speed with which the people of cricket had pursued their new and absolute purpose, the destruction of everything that wasn't cricket. It is also the only explanation for their bewilderingly sudden grasp of all the hyper-technology involved in building their thousands of spaceships and their millions of lethal white robots. These had really struck terror into the hearts of everyone who had encountered them. In most cases, however, the terror was extremely short-lived, as was the person experiencing the terror. They were savage, single-minded, flying battle machines. They wielded formidable multifunctional battle clubs which, brandished one way, would knock down buildings, and brandished another way, fired blistering omnidestructor zap rays, and brandished a third way, launched a hideous arsenal of grenades, ranging from minor incendiary devices to maxi-slaughter hypernuclear devices which could take out a major sun. Simply striking the grenades with the battle clubs simultaneously primed them and launched them with phenomenal accuracy over distances ranging from mere yards to hundreds of thousands of miles.
"Okay," said Judiciary Pag again. "So we won."
He paused and chewed a little gum.
"We won," he repeated. "But that's no big deal. I'm in a medium-sized galaxy against one little world, and how long did it take us, Clerk of the Court?"
"My lad,"
said a severe little man in black, rising.
"How long, kiddo?"
"It is a trifle difficult, my lad, to be precise in this matter, time and distance."
"Relax, guy, be vague."
"I hardly like to be vague, my lad, over such a—"
"Bite the bullet and be it."
The clerk of the court blinked at him. It was clear that, like most of the galactic legal profession, he found Judiciary Pag, or Zippo Bebrock 5×10⁸, as his private name was known inexplicably to be, a rather distressing figure. He was clearly a bounder and a cad. He seemed to think that the fact that he was the possessor of the finest legal mind ever discovered gave him the right to behave exactly as he liked. And unfortunately, he appeared to be right.
Well, my lad, very approximately 2,000 years,
the clerk murmured unhappily.
"And how many guys zilched out?"
2 grillion, my lad.
The clerk sat down. A hydrospectic photo of him at this point would have revealed that he was steaming slightly. Judiciary Pag gazed once more around the courtroom, wherein were assembled hundreds of the very highest officials of the entire galactic administration, all in their ceremonial uniforms or bodies depending on metabolism and custom. Behind a wall of zap-proof crystal stood a representative group of the people of cricket, looking with calm, polite loathing at all the aliens gathered to pass judgment on them. This was the most momentous occasion in legal history, and Judiciary Pag knew it. He took out his chewing gum and stuck it under his chair.
"That's a whole lot of stiffs," he said quietly.
The grim silence in the courtroom seemed in accord with this view.
"So, like I said, these are a bunch of really sweet guys, but you wouldn't want to share a galaxy with them. Not if they're just going to keep at it. Not if they're not going to learn to relax a little. I mean, it's just going to be continual nervous time, isn't it? Right? Pow, pow, pow! When are they next coming at us? Peaceful coexistence is just right out. Right? Get me some water, somebody. Thank you."
He sat back and sipped, reflectively.
"Okay," he said. "Hear me, hear me. It's like these guys, you know, are entitled to their own view of the universe, and according to their view, which the universe forced on them, right, they did right. Sounds crazy, but I think you'll agree. They believe in," he consulted a piece of paper which he found in the back pocket of his judicial jeans, "they believe in peace, justice, morality, culture, sport, family life, and the obliteration of all other life forms."
He shrugged.
"I've heard a lot worse," he said.
He scratched his crotch reflectively.
"Frio," he said.
He took another sip of water, then held it up to the light and frowned at it. He twisted it round.
"Hey, is there something in this water?" he said.
"No, my lord,"
said the court usher who had brought it to him rather nervously.
"Then take it away," snapped Judiciary Pag, "and put something in it. I got an idea."
He pushed away the glass and leaned forward.
"Hear me, hear me," he said.
The solution was brilliant and went like this. The planet of cricket was to be encased for perpetuity in an envelope of slow time, inside which life would continue almost infinitely slowly. All light would be deflected round the envelope so that it would remain invisible and impenetrable. Escape from the envelope would be utterly impossible unless it were unlocked from the outside. When the rest of the universe came to its final end, when the whole of creation reached its dying fall, this was all, of course, in the days before it was known that the end of the universe would be a spectacular catering venture, and life and matter ceased to exist, then the planet of cricket and its sun would emerge from its slow-time envelope and continue a solitary existence, such as it craved, in the twilight of the universal void. The lock would be on an asteroid which would slowly orbit the envelope. The key would be the symbol of the galaxy, the Wicket Gate. By the time the applause in the court had died down, Judiciary Pag was already in the censor shower with a rather nice member of the jury that he'd slipped a note to half an hour earlier.
Chapter 13. 2 months later, Zippo Bebrock 5x10 to the power 8 had cut the bottoms off his galactic state jeans and was spending part of the enormous fee his judgments commanded, lying on a jewelled beach having essence of qualactin rubbed into his back by the same rather nice member of the jury. She was a Sulfinian girl from beyond the cloud worlds of Yargar. She had skin like lemon silk and was very interested in legal bodies.
"Did you hear the news?" she said.
"Well, said Zippo Bebrock 5x10 to the power 8.
And you would have had to have been there to know exactly why he said this. None of this was on the tape of informational illusions and is all based on hearsay.
"No,"
he added, when the thing that had made him say, "Huella!" had stopped happening. He moved his body round slightly to catch the first rays of the third and greatest of primeval Vod's three suns, which was now creeping over the ludicrously beautiful horizon, and the sky now glittered with some of the greatest tanning power ever known. A fragrant breeze wandered up from the quiet sea, trailed along the beach, and drifted back to sea again, wondering where to go next. On a mad impulse, it went up to the beach again. It drifted back to sea.
"I hope it isn't good news," muttered Zippo Bebrock 5x10 to the power 8, "because I don't think I could bear it."
"Your cricket judgment was carried out today," said the girl sumptuously.
There was no need to say such a straightforward thing sumptuously, but she went ahead and did it anyway because it was that sort of day.
"I heard it on the radio," she said, "when I went back to the ship for the oil."
"Aha," murmured Zippo and rested his head back on the jewelled sand.
"Something happened," she said. Just after the slow time envelope was locked, she said, and paused a moment from rubbing in the essence of Qualactin, a cricket warship which had been missing, presumed destroyed, turned out to be just missing after all. It appeared and tried to seize the key. Zippo sat up sharply.
Hey, what?
He said. It's all right, she said in a voice which would have calmed the Big Bang down. Apparently there was a short battle. The key and the warship were disintegrated and blasted into the space-time continuum. Apparently they are lost forever. She smiled and ran a little more essence of Qualactin onto her fingertips. He relaxed and lay back down.
Do what you did a moment or two ago, he murmured.
That, she said.
No, no, he said. That.
She tried again. That? She asked.
Well,
Again, you had to be there. The fragrant breeze drifted up from the sea again. A magician wandered along the beach, but no one needed him. Chapter 14.
Nothing is lost forever, said Slarty Bartfast, his face flickering redly in the light of the candle which the robot waiter was trying to take away.
Except for the Cathedral of Chalism.
The what? Said Arthur with a start.
The Cathedral of Chalism, repeated Slarty Bartfast. It was during the course of my researches at the Campaign for Real Time that I...
The what? Said Arthur again.
The old man paused and gathered his thoughts for what he hoped would be one last onslaught on this story. The robot waiter moved through the space-time matrices in a way which spectacularly combined the surly with the obsequious, made a snatch for the candle, and got it. They had had the bill, had argued convincingly about who had had the cannelloni and how many bottles of wine they had had, and, as Arthur had been dimly aware, had thereby successfully manoeuvred the ship out of subjective space and into parking orbit round a strange planet. The waiter was now anxious to complete his part of the charade and clear the bistro.
All will become clear, said Slarty Bartfast.
When?
In a minute. Listen. The time streams are now very polluted. There's a lot of muck floating about in them, flotsam and jetsam, and more of it is now being regurgitated into the physical world. Eddies in the space-time continuum, you see.
So I hear, said Arthur.
Look, where are we going? Said Ford, pushing his chair back from the table with impatience, because I'm eager to get there.
We are going, said Slarty Bartfast in a slow, measured voice, to try to prevent the war robots of Cricket from regaining the whole of the key they need to unlock the planet of Cricket from the slow-time envelope and release the rest of their army and their mad masters.
It's just, said Ford, that you mentioned a party.
I did, said Slarty Bartfast, and hung his head.
He realised that it had been a mistake, because the idea seemed to exercise a strange and unhealthy fascination on the mind of Ford Prefect.
The more that Slarty Bartfast unravelled the dark and tragic story of Cricket and its people, the more Ford Prefect wanted to drink a lot and dance with girls. The old man felt that he should not have mentioned the party until he absolutely had to, but there it was. The fact was out, and Ford Prefect had attached himself to it the way an Arcturan megaleech attaches itself to a victim before biting his head off and making off with his spaceship.
When, said Ford eagerly, do we get there?
When I finish telling you why we have to go there.
I know why I'm going, said Ford, and leaned back, sticking his hands behind his head.
He gave one of his smiles which made people twitch.
Slarty Bartfast had hoped for an easy retirement. He had been planning to learn to play the octaventral Hebephone, a pleasantly futile task he knew because he had the wrong number of mouths. He had also been planning to write an eccentric and relentlessly inaccurate monograph on the subject of equatorial fjords, in order to set the record wrong about one or two matters he saw as important. Instead, he had somehow got talked into doing some part-time work for the Campaign for Real Time, and had started to take it all seriously for the first time in his life. As a result, he now found himself spending his fast-declining years combating evil and trying to save the galaxy. He found it exhausting work and sighed heavily.
"Ah, listen," he said. "At cam time..."
"What?" said Arthur, The campaign for real time, which I will tell you about later. I noticed that five pieces of jetsam, which had, in relatively recent times, plopped back into existence, seemed to correspond to the five pieces of the missing key. Only two I could trace exactly, the wooden pillar, which appeared on your planet, and the silver bale. It seems to be at some sort of party. We must go there to retrieve it before the cricket robots find it, or who knows what may happen.
No, said Ford firmly. We must go to the party in order to drink a lot and dance with girls.
But haven't you understood everything I...
Yes, said Ford with a sudden and unexpected fierceness. I've understood it all perfectly well. That's why I want to have as many drinks and dance with as many girls as possible while there are still any left. If everything you've shown us is true...
True? Of course it's true.
Then we don't stand a whelk's chance in a supernova.
A what? Said Arthur sharply again. He had been following the conversation doggedly up to this point and was keen not to lose the thread now.
A whelk's chance in a supernova, repeated Ford without losing momentum.
What's a whelk got to do with a supernova? Said Arthur.
It doesn't, said Ford levelly, stand a chance in one.
He paused to see if the matter was now cleared up. The freshly puzzled looks clambering across Arthur's face told him that it wasn't.
A supernova, said Ford as quickly and as clearly as he could, is a star which explodes at almost half the speed of light and burns with the brightness of a billion suns and then collapses as a super-heavy neutron star. It's a star which burns up other stars. Got it? Nothing stands a chance in a supernova.
I see, said Arthur. So why a whelk, particularly?
Why not a whelk? Doesn't matter!
Arthur accepted this, and Ford continued, picking up his early fierce momentum as best he could.
The point is, he said, that people like you and me, Slarty Barfast, and Arthur, particularly and especially Arthur, are just dilettantes, eccentrics, layabouts, fart-arounds, if you like.
Slarty Barfast frowned, partly in puzzlement and partly in umbrage. He started to speak. Is as far as he got.
We're not obsessed by anything, you see, insisted Ford. And that's the deciding factor. We can't win against obsession. They care, we don't, they win.
I care about lots of things, said Slarty Bartfast, his voice trembling partly with annoyance, but partly also with uncertainty.
Such as?
Well, said the old man, life, the universe, everything, really. Fjords?
Would you die for them?
Fjords? Blinked Slarty Bartfast in surprise. No.
Well, then!
Wouldn't see the point, to be honest.
And I still can't see the connection, said Arthur, with whelks.
Ford could feel the conversation slipping out of his control and refused to be sidetracked by anything at this point.
The point is, he hissed, that we are not obsessive people and we don't stand a chance against...
Except for your sudden obsession with whelks, pursued Arthur, which I still haven't understood.
Will you please leave whelks out of it?
I will if you will, said Arthur. You brought the subject up.
It was an error, said Ford. Forget them. The point is this.
He leant forward and rested his forehead on the tips of his fingers.
What was I talking about? He said wearily.
Let's just go down to the party, said Slarty Bartfast, for whatever reason. He stood up, shaking his head.
I think that's what I was trying to say, said Ford.
For some unexplained reason, the teleport cubicles were in the bathroom. Chapter 15. Time travel is increasingly regarded as a menace. History is being polluted. The Encyclopedia Galactica has much to say on the theory and practice of time travel, most of which is incomprehensible to anyone who hasn't spent at least four lifetimes studying advanced hypermathematics, and since it was impossible to do this before time travel was invented, there is a certain amount of confusion as to how the idea was arrived at in the first place. One rationalization of this problem states that time travel was, by its very nature, discovered simultaneously at all periods of history. But this is clearly bunk. The trouble is that a lot of history is now quite clearly bunk as well. Here is an example. It may not seem to be an important one to some people, but to others, it is crucial. It is certainly significant in that it was the single event which caused the campaign for real time to be set up in the first place, or is it last? It depends which way round you see history is happening, and this too is now an increasingly vexed question. There is, or was, a poet. His name was Lalafa, and he wrote what are widely regarded throughout the galaxy as being the finest poems in existence, the Songs of the Long Land. They are, were, unspeakably wonderful. That is to say, you couldn't speak very much of them at once without being so overcome with emotion, truth, and a sense of the wholeness and oneness of things that you wouldn't pretty soon need a brisk walk round the block, possibly pausing at a bar on the way back for a quick glass of perspective and soda. They were that good. Lalafa had lived in the forests of the long lands of Effa. He lived there, and he wrote his poems there. He wrote them on pages made of dried habra leaves, without the benefit of education or correcting fluid. He wrote about the light in the forest, and what he thought about that. He wrote about the darkness in the forest, and what he thought about that. He wrote about the girl who had left him, and precisely what he thought about that. Long after his death, his poems were found and wondered over. News of them spread like morning sunlight. For centuries they illuminated and watered the lives of many people whose lives might otherwise have been darker and drier. Then, shortly after the invention of time travel, some major correcting fluid manufacturers wondered whether his poems might have been better still if he had had access to some high-quality correcting fluid, and whether he might be persuaded to say a few words to that effect. They travelled the time waves, they found him, they explained the situation with some difficulty to him, and did indeed persuade him. In fact, they persuaded him to such effect that he became extremely rich at their hands, and the girl about whom he was otherwise destined to write with such precision never got around to leaving him. And in fact, they moved out of the forest to a rather nice pad in town, and he frequently commuted to the future to do chat shows, on which he sparkled wittily. He never got around to writing the poems, of course, which was a problem, but an easily solved one. The manufacturers of correcting fluid simply packed him off for a week somewhere with a copy of a later edition of his book and a stack of dried habra leaves to copy them out onto, making the odd deliberate mistake and correction on the way. Many people now say that the poems are suddenly worthless. Others argue that they are exactly the same as they always were, so what's changed? The first people say that that isn't the point. They aren't quite certain what the point is, but they are quite sure that that isn't it. They set up the Campaign for Real Time to try to stop this sort of thing going on. Their case was considerably strengthened by the fact that a week after they had set themselves up, news broke that not only had the Great Cathedral of Chalazim been pulled down in order to build a new iron refinery, but that the construction of the refinery had taken so long and had had to extend so far back into the past in order to allow iron production to start on time, that the Cathedral of Chalazim had now never been built in the first place. Picture postcards of the cathedral suddenly became immensely valuable. So, a lot of history is now gone forever. The Campaign for Real Timers claim that just as easy travel eroded the differences between one country and another, and between one world and another, so time travel is now eroding the differences between one age and another. The past, they say, is now truly like a foreign country. They do things exactly the same there. Chapter 16. Arthur materialised, and did so with all the customary staggering about and clasping at his throat, heart, and various limbs which he still indulged himself in whenever he made any of these hateful and painful materialisations that he was determined not to let himself get used to. He looked around for the others. They weren't there. He looked around for the others again. They still weren't there. He closed his eyes. He opened them. He looked around for the others. They obstinately persisted in their absence. He closed his eyes again, preparatory to making this completely futile exercise once more, and because it was only then, whilst his eyes were closed, that his brain began to register what his eyes had been looking at whilst they were open, a puzzled frown crept across his face. So he opened his eyes again to check his facts, and the frown stayed put. If anything, it intensified and got a good firm grip. If this was a party, it was a very bad one, so bad, in fact, that everyone else had left. He abandoned this line of thought as futile. Obviously, this wasn't a party. It was a cave, or a labyrinth, or a tunnel, or something. There was insufficient light to tell. All was darkness, a damp, shiny darkness. The only sounds were the echoes of his own breathing, which sounded worried. He coughed very slightly, and then had to listen to the thin, ghostly echo of his cough, trailing away amongst winding corridors and sightless chambers, as of some great labyrinth, and eventually returning to him via the same unseen corridors as if to say, "Yes?" This happened to every slightest noise he made, and it unnerved him. He tried to hum a cheery tune, but by the time it returned to him it was a hollow dirge and he stopped. His mind was suddenly full of images from the story that Slarty Bartfast had been telling him. He half expected suddenly to see lethal white robots step silently from the shadows and kill him. He caught his breath. They didn't. He let it go again. He didn't know what he did expect. Someone or something, however, seemed to be expecting him, for at that moment there lit up suddenly in the dark distance an eerie green neon sign. It said, silently, "You have been diverted." The sign flicked off again, in a way which Arthur was not at all certain he liked. It flicked off with a sort of contemptuous flourish. Arthur then tried to assure himself that this was just a ridiculous trick of his imagination. A neon sign is either on or off, depending on whether it has electricity running through it or not. There was no way, he told himself, that it could possibly affect the transition from one state to the other with a contemptuous flourish. He hugged himself tightly in his dressing gown and shivered, nevertheless. The neon sign in the depths now suddenly lit up, bafflingly, with just three dots and a comma. Like this. Dot, 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 comma. Only in green neon. It was trying, Arthur realized after staring at this perplexedly for a second or two, to indicate that there was more to come, that the sentence was not complete. Trying with almost superhuman pedantry, he further reflected, or at least inhuman pedantry. The sentence then completed itself with these two words. Arthur Dent. He reeled. He steadied himself to have another clear look at it. It still said Arthur Dent, so he reeled again. Once again the sign flicked off and left him blinking in the darkness with just the dim red image of his name jumping on his retina. "Welcome," the sign now suddenly said. After a moment it added, "I don't think." The stone-cold fear which had been hovering around Arthur all this time, waiting for its moment, recognized that its moment had now come and pounced on him. He tried to fight it off. He dropped into a kind of alert crouch that he had once seen somebody do on television, but it must have been somebody with stronger knees. He peered huntedly into the darkness.